sit in on this. We both used to work in Willapa Bay, Grace Harbor, so hopefully my brain to my right will engage later, and we'll get through all of your questions that you might have. This is an important presentation from my perspective. So not that others aren't or haven't been.
And in our defense, the slides were put together by Chad, so we're not going to take the blame for some of them being a little busy.
Wow, he did. He's sick, and he threw him under the bus. That's great.
So he's watching.
So again, I hope he has a speedy recovery. So today we're going to review the Willapa Bay policy and talk about the different components of that policy. As we go through the presentation, we tried to denote 2019 with an asterisk just because it's going to be preliminary data. We want to talk about the recent events of egg takes that we have talked about at last month's commission meeting, and bring that back to your attention, and also seek guidance on any modifications to the policy that you might have in offering your guidance to us for the 2020 North Falcon season. So the graph is a way to look at individual years. So the stacked bars are different areas in which the Chinook are caught in the multiple locations throughout their migratory pattern. So you can see how the top piece, and I'm not going to try to guess what colors these are, but Alaska, then California.
Canada.
Sorry, Canada. Thank you. I don't see, other than very thin lines, anything caught in Juan de Fuca or Puget Sound. But then there's the Washington coast, so our ocean coastal fishery, and then the Willapa net harvest that occurs every year. And it's just to really show from coded wire tags the declining exploitation rates that have occurred over time in conjunction with previous Pacific Salmon Commission, Pacific Salmon Treaty implementation of previous annexes, as well as the most recent 2019 annex that was put into place. The other thing is that we don't have robust monitoring in Willapa. I know Chad usually works that in to his presentations a couple of different times, so I'll probably do that in his spirit here. So we'll keep that in mind as we get through our current legislation, as well as hopefully some additional fees, and looking forward as we become whole. So I'd like to spend just a hair bit of time to orient you to this slide. You're going to see it three times, one for Chinook, one for Coho, and one for Chum. And so as you can see, there's a reddish color and green colors. Those are really just the visual indicators of whether we made our predicted levels or not, whether it's in the impact rate that was provided either through guidance or the original policy or the actual escapement for each of those species. So pretty easy to indicate that we have not made natural spawning escapement for Chinook for the last 5 years. And in recent years, we've actually hit our impact rate three of the last 5 years and three of the most recent years. While I'm on this slide, I would like to point out something that did come up, a question at the Fish Committee meeting yesterday of, in the predicted impact rate column, we have a 19.3 in 2017, a 17.8% in 2018, and a 15.4% in 2019. Those were all due, even though each of those years had a 20% harvest rate cap associated to Chinook for that season, those could not be achieved because of other constraining stocks. And as we progress through this, I will try to give you an indication of where we are, if we know, for the upcoming forecasts. So in recent years, we're going to see what we assume, because of a fairly long data set, of a similar level of wild Chinook returning. And we think that a similar level of hatchery Chinook returning because of how they graduate into different year classes. And I'll get into a little bit of that information as we go through the presentation.
Chairman, and if you're going to get to this later, then you don't have to answer it now. But of the 8.2 and the 14.7 that came in so low, sometimes in the sport fishery you get a dynamic where if the fishing is really good, then a lot of people come to fish, and then the exploitation rate can go up because effort goes up. When the fishing is poor, people just don't come, and the exploitation rate goes down because the fishing's poor. Nobody wants to come. Is that dynamic happening in the exploitation rate coming in lower here than expected? And of that exploitation rate, is it still the situation that the majority of that is from the sport fishery? Or because the success is poor, that the sport fishery is just waning and it's just not there?
Exploitation rate or impact rate?
Impact rate, excuse me.
So, Chair Carpenter, Commissioner McIsaac, I will start off. I think Kurt has some thoughts about that as well. I would say yes, partially. I think that where we use the Chinook incidentally for the commercial fishery, because coho have been tapering off, and then the chum 10% cap in recent years, I think both of those play into why that's happening. In addition to that, I believe that the last at least 2 years we've had in-season management where we've identified lower returns than had been predicted, so we'd taken in-season actions. So I think the combination of what you described of people just not coming because they're not hearing of the bites on, as well as those in-season actions and those other factors that play into that fishery, I think that those are all cumulative to why the actuals are as low as they are. So I'm sure if I were Chad, I'd do a much better job on this set of graphs than I likely will. But just to be able to describe, look at some trends from 2000 to 2019 in each of the four watersheds for wild Chinook escapement, and the trend lines that are put in place, do want to draw your attention to 2000 through 2014 in each graph. The blue bars, those are pre-policy, and then the 2015 through 19 are post-policy. And just to see the fairly flat trend line, slightly upward in the Willapa
as a whole.
Bay as a whole. The North River, fairly severe downward decline, although in recent years, a little bit of an uptick. The Willapa River Wildfall Chinook, a bit of an upward climb. So looks like the last 3 years, wild Chinook above the goal in the Willapa River. And then the Nacelle, what I would class as pretty chronically below the escapement goal, but a pretty flat trend analysis line that we're looking at. So then to also further look at how we're doing as we implement your policy, again, we try to indicate where we have pre-policy implementation versus post-policy. This is landed harvest for Chinook. And you can see how pre-policy versus post-policy, the harvest for Chinook has flipped from the majority being commercial to the majority being recreational in each of the years. As I look at 2015 through 19, I see a downward decline of catch, but it looks fairly proportional to me from a perspective of each sector catching and having what we intended by the original policy and having a priority of recreational fisheries and in this particular instance. So then on to chum salmon, same graph. You can see that we have been successful in achieving actual impact rates. This is all while we've had a 10% cap. Again, in the recent years, we've had declining coho populations, which has driven some effort, so not as many commercial license holders participating in the fishery, but achieving that from the predicted preseason planning to the actual. And then also 4 out of 5 years making the escapement goal for chum returning to systems within Willapa Bay. That feels pretty good to me. So, again, the same look for coho, wild coho within Willapa Bay. We don't have parameters for the impact rate like we do the other two species that we've seen previous. But we are looking at escapement goals, and here we see that 4 out of 5 years we have not made the escapement goal, and to put an indicator on what our early forecast looks like, we don't have it finalized, but our early indications for your purposes is that we may have less than 1,000 harvestable coho above the escapement goal for this season within Willapa Bay. And I didn't cover it, but on the chum slide previous, I don't have any advanced look at the chum forecast. We're still modifying the model to try to take in some ocean conditions and assure that the model's working correctly, but staff are diligently trying to finalize that so we have the earliest possible look at that as we can. So then to again look at landed coho catch pre policy and post-policy. Had a pre-policy that was certainly heavily towards commercial. Our values or our priority for Coho shifts to the commercial fleet, and you can see that 4 of the 5 years that is achieved. We have had some very severe years for return. We've had one disaster declaration that we've worked with the governor's office and through the federal agencies to get disaster money for commercial fishermen in that period of time, and continue to monitor this as closely as we can. So then this slide, although appears to be fairly busy, I'm hoping to take just a bit of time on this, not because you're way ahead of schedule, but because I think it's worthy of trying to understand really what it does and what it's trying to show. So what we're trying to depict here, illustrate here, is that what is the probability of harvesting fish in from each of the hatchery facilities in the 2T, 2U area, which is within the circle. So if you follow the river systems upstream, you can see that... it doesn't show up. So I'd get up, but then I don't have a mic. You can see where Forks Creek is and NEMA is and then Nacelle. So you can see the three different facilities within the bay. Hopefully you can read your slides to be able to see the 2T, 2U, 2N, 2R, 2T, sorry, 2M, different marine catch areas that we have within the bay that we try to record differently so that we, as we set time and area for different fisheries, we can do it in a way that accounts for the composition of the fish that are there at the time.
Commissioner Anderson, thank you. The Marine Area 2-1, is that the bay prior to a particular point in the season? How is that referenced in the chart?
So, Chair Carpenter, Commissioner Anderson, thank you for the question. So Marine Area 2-1 is Willapa Bay
as a whole,
and then we further divide that into catch areas within the bay so that we can try to refine and continue to challenge our models and our expertise to offer opportunity within with a clear understanding of how each of those areas are affected by time and those areas within each of the fisheries that are offered to...
That I don't understand exactly. It occurs in North Bay, and by definition, it'd be in the entire bay. Right?
Sure.
Or am I missing something?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Carpenter, Commissioner Anderson. So 2-1 is specifically a reference to the sport fishery area of Willapa Bay. Then the alphanumeric or numeric alpha are the designations for the commercial fishery, the specific sub areas within Area 2. Okay. And so the reference to the Marine Area 2-1 occurring in North Bay is the bulk of the marine area sport fishery is targeting in that upper portion of Willapa Bay, what is effectively 2T and 2U to the north end of the bay there.
As I was preparing this slide raised a question for me that's sort of related. As I was also reading the hatchery paper. As we moved into this policy, there were decisions made about the biologic designation of our hatcheries that actually switched things. Was it this intent that helped with that decision making? It'd be really helpful to me to have a little historical background on what went into the decision making and hatchery, biologic hatchery designation.
So, Chair Carpenter, Commissioner Thorburn, thanks for the question. I think it's been a while since I've been out there, and it's been a while since Kurt's been out there. So there's two different points here. We were trying to develop, as we had management plans in place prior to the commission policy, we needed an ability to really start to track by river of origin what we were catching and where. And so we initiated some coated wire tag evaluation, and we did some test fishing in different time periods within the bay with some of our commercial license holders
prior to
establish the commercial areas of 2M through 2U. The recreational portion isn't really counted like that. It's a 2-1 fishery. It's just that the bulk of the fishery occurs in that north area. That's where the launch points are. That's where the access is. And although I don't fish that area, the easy to return home and if conditions were to get rough. So you want to have anything else?
Maybe just a little in addition to that. Prior to 2010, the area that Ron has referred to as 2T, 2M, and 2N was one area for the commercial fishery, 2G. So by separating that into this different sub-areas, we were hoping to be able to target hatchery production in the commercial fishery better. And in the sport fishery, knowing that it primarily operates out of, as Ron said, Tokeland and to Raymond in that north end of the bay, we've had a pretty good feel for where the sport fishery impacts on the specific rivers of origin. And even though we don't have a good bit of monitoring historically until 2017, we really didn't have much in the way of a krill that was collecting coated wire tags from Willapa Bay 2-1 fisheries. And so we had really good specific information on the larger 2G area from the commercial fishery. In what's 2U, we had good information. And then in the very south end of the bay, what's 2M, we had reasonable information because that was a specific standalone area at the time previously. So largely what we tried to do with a more comprehensive tagging program was to get more specific river of origin data from the commercial fishery so that we could better target those specific stocks. And what this slide also goes to show you, as Ron was starting to indicate, in terms of the proportionality, so per release, what's your likelihood of catching it in a given area. As you look at that blue boxes on the bottom, the hatchery origin, I'll focus on, which is the one to the left, and where you catch the fish from Forks Creek releases, very few of those are caught in 2M. You can see that the preponderance of catch is occurring in 2T and 2U. Similarly, Nema fish are caught in very low levels in many of the areas throughout Willapa Bay. And then the nacelle fish, conversely to Forks Creek, the preponderance are caught in the 2M and 2N areas with lower catches, but still fairly well represented in 2T and 2U, just simply because that's the major mixed stock area. So they're moving through there when the fisheries are occurring.
So this was just an effort to show as you consider some of the egg take information and a possible move of eggs, where each of these releases then may show up and benefit the sectors in which we were are trying to offer opportunity to. And you can see I'll focus just on the hatchery origin return, but as Kurt did. So hopefully that's helpful. This is just to remind us all that as you have Chinook returning to the system, that you've got age 2 through age 5 in different composition or proportions. So age 2 fish at a 2% level, 3-year-olds at about 28%, 4-year-olds at 54%, and then 5-year-olds at the 16% level. And so where that comes into play is when we look at what's happened over time relative to different production levels at the facilities. So this, although it seems a bit busy, Forks Creek is the 4 years on top, then they sell 4 years, and then Nema with the different production values, and then it shows the year classes that are returning. You can see that from Forks Creek, and we've heard from public testimony about how we need fish back in the Forks Creek facility because it drives the fishery, and this year we've got no returning. We've got returning 5-year-olds, but it's a decrease from that, from 3.2 million to just shy of 400,000. So a big decrease in the facility that has, for a long time, driven all of the fisheries, I believe, or a significant portion of the fisheries within the bay. Nacelle, has increased. We heard that yesterday in the Fish Committee meeting. Some of that, we had specific guidelines from policy and then had different legislative actions directing us to raise additional fish in that facility, which we have done. And then I think a little later we'll have a slide that will actually show additional production that we've been trying to add to facilities because of the southern resident orca population assistance for prey that we want you to understand as well. So can see the production increases in Nacelle and what then's going to be offering. So this nearly 2.5 million, the 4-year-olds, the 54% that return in that age class. And then at Nema, the 4-year-old age class at 54% from almost a 3.2 million return. But that big driver of the recreational fishery up here is we're going to start to see the decline as those hatchery reform actions take hold, where we're trying to increase the productivity of wild versus the strain rate, cause and effect of the strain rate within that system.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Getting back to that previous question about whether you should plan on a high sport fishery impact rate in 2020, if the North End is now to full age classes coming off of a minor release, and most of those fish are in the north. If that was all there was, you would expect there to be poor sport fishing, and you're not going to draw the crowds from a lot of people because there are boat limits around. It does look like, though, when you bump the nacelle up by 300%, and some of those fish are caught in area 2T, and 2N, that maybe things might be a little bit better. But in the mix, this heavy reliance on Forks Creek hatchery might make you think the fishing's not going to be too good if the forecast altogether is about like it was last year, but most of the fish are heading to the south. So is that the right kind of thinking as we move forward to considering your recommendation about whether we should stay to the cap or go to 14%, or what do we have a pickle this year, or is the sport fishery just not going to have a big impact rate because no one's going to come?
Chair Carpenter, Commissioner McIsaac, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think that I'll show my ignorance. Because I don't like the example of having a pickle, I don't fully understand it. When Mr. Hamilton and I have our regular sessions on the phone, he keeps calling it a pickle, and I keep saying, will you explain that to me again? And he's going to get through to me one of these days. I know he is. But I think you're absolutely right. The fear that we've heard from those folks who fish this body of water on a regular basis, they're nervous because of that production shift we've seen and the failure that it will offer or could offer that fishery up in that 2T area. Now, it doesn't mean that as a mixed stock area that those fish aren't available, but still those fish going into 2U, as remembering back in our test fishing days, zero nacelle fish showed up in the 2U catch area. At least that's the way I recall it. It may have been a very small amount, but I don't believe any did. And therefore, you're not going to get any benefit in that mixing as you, if you can go back a couple. As you come back in here in past the Tokelund Marina and North River and get into the eastern side of 2T and 2U where it's popular to fish, you're not going to get a strong mixing effect there. And you wanted to point out something?
Yeah, thanks, Ron. So I was just saying that it is about 20% that show up in 2U. So it is a fairly small piece, but for the 2T area, it's closer to 40%. So there's a strong availability. The issue is that as Ron said, that the sport fishery occurring further east and in 2T and into 2U will be less successful fishing on nacelle fish that have moved into that area. But then there is the other portion of the fishery that does occur from Tokelund, which is pretty much straight above where it says 2T, out to Washaway Beach, where that line is on the left-hand side of the oval. That's the 2-1-2 boundary.
Or the line between Willapaw and the ocean fishery. So then some additional information that we have relative to the hatchery production that we wanted to share is just, this is NEMA Hatchery. NEMA Hatchery admittedly has had weir problems. We have a deficiency in some of the ongoing maintenance that we have there. I think that understanding what the state of facilities are or the level of deterioration that they're in is important as you make decisions. But even at that, the NEMA facility has not been achieving some of the egg take goals that it's had. And so what this is showing is that you've got the line of what the egg take goals are through time, and other than this year right here, the top pieces where it's red are where it has been backfilled from Forks Creek, other than that single year in 2011 where it was backfilled from nacelle. And so either through a total recruitment problem or aged and deteriorated facility issue with the weir, we have a trapping problem to secure our egg takes there and continue to move eggs to that facility. That's not to try to diminish your choice of what to do with Fry. It's just information that I think's important.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said because of the deterioration of a weir, so sometimes a hatchery can't get their fish back on a regular basis because it's just in a poor survival situation. But you're indicating it's not that, it's because of some deterioration of the fish collection device?
I think so, Chair Carpenter, Commissioner McIsaac, I think in this instance I'm still got the other part of the slide to go, and maybe you've been reading ahead. And and that's okay. I encourage that. So what we tried to do is we've got multiple brood years of fish that have had coated wire tag in this bottom portion. Okay. Okay. So Forks Creek has had coated wire tags from 2003 through 2011. NEMA 03 through 06, and then a couple of different groupings of coated wire tag application to the nacelle fish, 03 through 06, and then 09 through 11. And from that, our heat unit has developed, hey, here's the smolt to adult survival, 0.43% for Forks Creek and nacelle, and 0.28 for NEMA. So just another indication of what's going on with the facilities that we're operating, returning fish, and to give you a better, clearer picture of the decisions that you might have today.
Mr. Thurman.
So is, in recent years, NEMA the only one that we've surplus or added to from other hatcheries in the basin?
My recollection, sorry, Commissioner, as I recall, the nacelle add to NEMA was when we changed production in 2010, and then largely nacelle has been self-sustaining, and Forks Creek has always been self-sustaining as well. And so I think that the primary issue here is not that we've increased the production, but it is, as Ron indicated, a survival, the small to adult recruit piece, as well as, and more recently, increased production requirements or goals, and the facility issues. I seem to recall that the weir at one point was compromised by a beaver. So it is something that I think Ron did a good job of characterizing.
So if I can, maybe I'll just jump back just to the previous slide and remind us what the different production levels were. And fair enough, we think we capture all of the age classes upon return, but you can see that the other than NEMA, those production values have changed pretty dramatically over the years between Forks Creek and nacelle, with the different policy choices, first by just the department within the region, and then the shift to a primary population at Forks Creek by the commission during the adoption period of the policy. So then an additional slide that tried to describe further the production for this year. This was a year where we had conversations, recommendations from the Southern Resident Orca Task Force assembled by the governor's office. And we were attempting to increase Chinook within Willapa Bay by 2.55 million. We were trying to increase coho production by 300,000. That was at Forks Creek. I believe the 2.55 million was all at nacelle. And then the 1 million chum, I believe, was something that we were trying to do either at NEMA or NEMA and Forks Creek. So just trying to get some additional prey availability out for orcas and try to achieve some goals for the recommendations from the task force itself. Again, just to recap kind of this slide for those in the audience that weren't here yesterday, but those who were here and need the recap, we've got $2.59 million Chinook on hand at Forks Creek. The goal was $400,000. The release goal is, I believe, is 350,000, somewhere between 350 and 380. But 2019 Future Brood document said 350,000. The NEMA for Chinook 1.7 million. Forks Creek 1.7 million coho. On hand, 600,000 was the goal. That's the increase of the 300,000 plus at Forks Creek. And then Chum, 600,000 on hand versus the 500,000 release goal. Instead of going through all of them, I'll just leave it to say that the decision here is the difference between the difference in what our goals were and what's on hand for the Chinook populations at the three facilities. So your goal was 350,000 release at Forks Creek. You've got 2.59 million at NEMA. You've got less than half of your goal with 1.22 million, and then you've also got less than half of your goal at Nacelle at 2.1. So absent the southern resident killer whale, you're nearly achieving the egg take goal and release goals for Nacelle. It's the NEMA facility that is being dramatically shorted within this structure of where we were able to take eggs and are currently incubating and rearing fish. Through today's decision, we still have the ability to get fish to other facilities, get them mass marked or coated wire tagged and released by the time the rearing cycle is typically up. It's more work, but that's work that our hatchery staff do very, very well, and we can accommodate any decision that you make on this particular topic. Thanks. So what are the things that we can also look at? We know we have a continuation of some poor conditions, poor environmental conditions. I think I told the story yesterday of a recent Pacific Salmon Commission meeting that we attended, and one of the ocean experts, Lori Whitecamp from NOAA Fisheries, was there and showed us the stoplight map of 22 years of ocean conditions. And the last, I think, 6 years, we've got 1 year that was yellow. The rest are red, and we've got a heat wave right now. And although shallow, which means that if the right currents and wind conditions occur, it could dissipate quickly, we've still got really poor salmon conditions in our ocean. And we want to be thoughtful of that, and thoughtful for more than just the Chinook discussion. One of the things that Dr. Whitecamp reminded us of was that chum, as they migrate out, typically migrate out due west. They don't hug shorelines. They don't stay out of that warm water. They go out and through it just like steelhead do. So we've got a situation where as we see these declining numbers both in for chum and Puget Sound on our Washington coast, have to be thoughtful for what that those marine conditions are actually doing to the released fish as well as the wild populations as they migrate through their life history. So I kind of covered the what we know about forecasts so far in each of the areas or species that we do know about. We've covered the where we've achieved our conservation objectives and where we haven't relative to those escapement goals that are so important to our sustainable populations as well as our opportunities for all of the species that we have here. So then I will remind, I'll go through a table and remind us of where we are from at least a couple of the options that we considered or we put together for your consideration. Our first, what I'll do is I'll go through the column on the far right, which is what we've done the last couple of years. And so we've had a harvest control of a 20% impact rate on unmarked Chinook or wild natural, whichever you'd like to prefer. If Joe Anderson was here, he'd probably be smacking me on the back of the head saying they're not wild. There's some, for the recreational fishery, there's staff flexibility on bag limits in recent years, as I believe is an adaptive management approach that could be adopted within the current policy the way it's written. I think that both are showing from the data that we showed that there's a recreational priority on the fisheries that are occurring. And then the commercial fisheries, no restrictions on time and area in recent years, but there are time and area restrictions on the policy as it's written. For coho, our guidance is conservation. We appreciate that, and we're trying to do everything we can and need to do everything we can to minimize our impact so that we can achieve our spawner escapement goals within Willapaw Bay. It's going to be a tough year for coho. And chum, in recent years, we've had a 10% impact rate. No commercial fisheries between October 15th and 31st. That's kind of the prime hit. We've tried to stay off the peak when we've had that 10% in place, and the recreational fishery would have allowed retention. In the policy itself, where we've achieved goals, the 10% currently comes off, and it would meet, our direction would be to meet aggregate escapement goals. There would be no restrictions on time frames under the current policy. However, with the number of coho that are predicted to come back and know that we have that not only directed, well, incidental catch on chum on coho, and then you shift that into chum time and the incidental impact on coho, so the flip-flop of those, I can't imagine much opportunity being available, and we're going to have to be very thoughtful about what we do so that we can maximize any opportunity as we do in all locations, but per our mandate, per our targeted goals to meet the conservation goals of each river system and or body of water that we're trying to manage.
So let me just make sure I understand that. So under the policy, ordinarily, I mean, since we've made the escapement, I'm looking back at the chum table, we've made escapement goal four of the past 5 years, so then that those restrictions, that 10% would come off, right? Is that, but you're saying for 2020, even though the policy would remove the restrictions on chum, coho is going to be so constraining that your recommendation is that we keep that 10% restriction in place for CHUM. Is that, am I getting that right?
Chair Carpenter, Commissioner Kehoe. What it boils down to, at least from my perspective, is where you're going to be. If you adopt guidelines absent the policy, then yes, I think that it's not going to be constraining if you keep the 10% on the CHUM population, because I'm not sure we can get to 10% anyway with the coho constraints that we're going to have in the Bay. So I think regardless, if you were to go back to the original policy, coho's still going to drive the CHUM fishery.
So that was my question then.
Yep.
I think so.
Yep.
You expect coho to be so constraining that for all intents and purposes, you know, we're going to be stuck with a restriction on the CHUM fishery, right?
I mean, yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before I ask the question, there's only one more slide left, so let me make sure that I compliment that the policy director, former director of the fish program, can move to new jobs and do an exceptional job and carry the ball in a very nice manner and answer questions and everything else. So I have 32 more questions.
That's why I brought Kurt.
I packed a lunch.
With regard to the guidance last year for the commercial fishery for Chinook on no restrictions on time and area, in the Fish Committee meeting yesterday, we heard some comment about some real early openers for the commercial fishery and fishing in a lot of different areas than had been in the past. So when was the first opener for the commercial fishery for Chinook, and in what area?
Chair Carpenter, Commissioner McIsaac, I believe that the earliest opener was September 3rd. Do you have something else?
But it was in the south end.
Yeah, and that was the southern portion of the bay. So we opened 4 days early in the southern portion of the bay.
And when did it open in the north areas? I got my twos all mixed up here. 2T or north?
September 16th. It's not in there.
Was it earlier than September
16th? So my memory just kicked in. Thank you, Barbara McClellan. we opened on the 16th in the north 16th. End.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. So, and that's within the policy. So I just wanted to remind this is the kind of the north end, the south end, in recent years has been new. I think everybody's still figuring out some of the water, but haven't heard a lot of complaints. Although I'm sure that if I asked for complaints, I'd get a lot. So I don't want to go too far.
Thank you. Just one more. As you get to your very last slide, what is the Chinook egg take goal for 2020 at the three facilities?
Commissioner McIsaac, 8.7 million Chinook within the three facilities is the goal currently.
That's with the Orca addition.
Commissioner Thorburn, yes, it is. If Kurt's math is right.
Don't ask the director.
Uh-oh.
And I was a little focusing on the Forks Creek hatchery, where there's been this debate about. So the goal would be 0.4 for 2020, unless changed.
So, Chair Carpenter, Commissioner McIsaac, the goal, unless changed, I believe the release goal, egg take goal is 400,000. Release goal is between 350 and 380,000 Chinook from that facility.
Currently constrained by the coho.
So as we put this together, I will admit that we did not have the at least preliminary draft of any of the forecasts. We didn't have an idea of the coho forecast and the constraining the constraints that that may present. We still don't have a good look at Chum, although ocean conditions, last year's returns in ocean conditions, I'm nervous about that. And Chinook, we're estimating, at least right now, because of the age structure shifts and where those fish are, that it'll be similar to last year. But with the constraints around coho and other things, that coho number is going to drive what we do in the bay, except when you're really early. So in July 1, you're still fishing under the ocean conditions. You have dip-in fish, those non-local stocks that drop in or swing into Willapaw while they're feeding and still heading for the Columbia River or other natal streams. So going to be a difficult year to plan fisheries. I'm hoping that, as has always been the case, that our constituents come with their passion and their understanding both equally to help us engage in the North Falcon process.
Okay. I see the last one here says questions. Are there questions before we go to the open public comments piece? Mr. Thornburg.
Question. Looking at various slides here and trying to put together the Forks Creek egg take being as high as it is, now we're at the very end of the last high release of the tail end, and next year, you know, we're going to have returns only from when we lowered the release from the hatchery. Why has it remained as high as it has, as we should be declining, it seems to me, at this point? I'm just thinking of this going forward. What's going to happen with the designations and everything? I'm not asking my question really well, but there's a whole bunch of information in this presentation that makes me question what's going on in Forks Creek and the other.
So, Chair Carpenter, Commissioner Thorburn, I think although it's difficult because there's so much information here to formulate a question, and I certainly understand that, I think what we're seeing is the evolution of the policy coming into effect. And I wish that we had more staff so that the comprehensive review was done and that this could be a conversation about input that we've received from the public and the information you receive from staff, and do you want to continue with the same policy that you've had in recent years, or the modifications that you've given to us in recent years. I don't have that answer. I do think that it's worthy of a look to say, are there flexibilities within the Hatchery Scientific Review Group principles, which are still in effect in this policy? Those were not put on hold, or paused. So do we want to say, hey, let's try to even this back out for a year or two, a year while we finalize the comprehensive plan, get back to a more equitable approach of production and release goals across the bay, and then begin to, if you hate it, don't use it. Structure the implementation of the policy in a different way to achieve the goals that you choose to try to achieve if you modify your policy?
So we're not going to punt. That's good.
No punting. It's first down, and you're on the 5-yard line.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. What I'm going to propose here to the commission is I think we've got 10 or 12 individuals that want to speak to us. We'll do that, and then we'll take a break to do a number of things, and then we'll come back and make a decision. So those of you that are in the audience, you know the plan here. You come up, you get 3 minutes. We want to hear what you have to say. So I'll name three off. Three at a time would come up, please. Dale Beasley, Tim Hamilton, and Ross Barkhurst.
If you yell that for the next half hour.
Mr. Beasley, welcome.
Yeah, good afternoon, Chair Carpenter and the commission here. 3 minutes isn't near enough time to get anything out, so I will remind you that over the last year I've sent you over 100 pages of material to read. I've got a couple of things to say. I've talked to a lot of people, and I represent a lot of people, and everyone, it doesn't matter if they're rec or commercial, they want to see salmon with dinner plate results. Going wild policy takes salmon off of the public's dinner plates. I don't care what stripe of fishermen they are. NOAA's been studying smolt catches in the ocean for quite some time, and about 90 to 95% of the smolts that they recover in the ocean are of hatchery origin. That means that the wild fish aren't doing very well in the ocean, and you're going to have trouble getting large numbers of those back to the creeks to spawn. So, as we move forward here, the public in this state, and I'm going to repeat it one more time, they want to see salmon on their dinner plates. And without ample hatchery production, I don't care if it's in the Willapaw or wherever it is, all over the state we need this. It's the same answer for the folks. And they're the ones that are paying the freight here, whether it's in their taxes or their BPA electric rates, they're paying for these salmon. And without seeing them on their plates, we're failing. And I could go on for quite some time. Our orcas are starving, our fish-dependent communities are starving, and I will remind you, I quit salmon fishing in 1979. Today, the folks that are salmon fishing are working on 1% of the harvest rates that I had back in 1979. Now, most of the dams were built before 79. We had something going on between now and then. A lot of it has been policy besides what's been going on in urban areas. So you got to think about when you spend your dollars, where you're going to get the best bang for your buck, and it's going to be in non-urban areas. The Willapaw Bay is an excellent place to raise as many fish as you can. In the past, we've had a lot more salmon and Chinook salmon coming back to this bay than we've had in recent years. And when you cut down your hatchery production like you have at Forks Creek, the people are going to suffer. I don't care who it is, whether it's sport or commercial. They're not going to get the fish for their dinner plate that are getting paid for by the fish. And I just want to remind you of that. And I could go on for a long time, but I'm going to cut it off right here.
Thank you for coming
in.
Be
nice to you guys.
Yeah. Whoever's next.
I'll go first. It's a quick state of Willapa Bay, and then the next two will talk to you about proposal for having an optimum policy going forward. The bay is in extremis. It's at the point of death. This is where aggressive measures need to be taken and not business as usual. We're going to need a change in the mindset which got us here. The original policy may have avoided this. It doesn't matter. We are where we are. We didn't follow it. All that matters is what we do going forward. We've taken what we've learned under 5 years of the policy as a modified, and we've turned that into a proposal for going back to the original policy with seven minor modifications. Every leading indicator tells us we're in trouble. We need a reset. It can only come from the top, which is why we're here talking to you today. The old mindset is saying, well, let's stick with the what we call pickles, the modifications of the policy, and we're asking you, please don't do that. It hasn't worked. I would like to, if you have the handouts, if you would look at slide 5 and 6 and give you a bigger picture interpretation of what's been going on. The wild Chinook abundance trends shows kind of sort of level for the last 20 years in Willapa Bay. But look at the North River and the Willapa River wild escapement. It's going up. Okay. And what's been going on there? We followed the policy there. We didn't put commercial in before the 16th, and fish got through. Then look at the Nazelle River. Okay. It's hard to tell what's left. 500 fish, 550 fish, the lowest in 20 years. And what did we do in front of the Nazelle River? We used a policy modification and put nets in on the third. So essentially, that's a contributing stream. Okay? Essentially, it's now contributing nothing, and it's predictable. I would also look at slide 6, which shows a pretty good-looking trend of recreational harvest, but if you look at the double asterisk there, this is a 5-year average. If you went to the doctor and you thought you might have an infection and you had a high white blood cell count, okay? Well, we'll take a look at it. And then 4 days later, well, your average is only about 3 times normal. But today, it's 10 times normal. You probably got an infection. We got one. And so we really need to put a stop to it. Tim and Marlisa can talk to you about some recommendations.
Okay. Thank you, Russ. Tim, you're next, Marlisa.
Thank you. I would hope that you don't start my timer until I respond to Ron. I'm going to put pickle out there as long as this department keeps it on the menu. Okay. If they take it off the menu, I'll burn my shirt. I want to point out something and follow up from what Ross said. When you go to this hatchery figures and you see what the egg takes and things are and you see where the performance was, what the effect of, regardless of the intent, was when we developed the policy that was going to be a recreational priority for Chinook. The place where the opportunity greatest was up north. At that stage of the game, the department convinced everybody we have to go prime in the Willapa River. They then turned around and cut all the hatchery production back and oriented all the hatchery production back to the south. Well, who gets to catch them in the south? It isn't the poles. Okay? So it's primarily to put nets in. Now, here's the problem. When you go to slide number, what is that, four? Five. I guess, five. Go to slide number five. On the lower right-hand slide, you'll see that the natural origin spawners coming back to the nacelle with all those 5 million egg takes is less than a third of the escapement goal. If they followed HSRG and they took every natural origin fish we can, they can't reach PIAS. That's how bad it is. That's bad it is. And guess what? Next year it'll be less. You have destroyed. In the meantime, go look over to the north. We all went up. Okay? So what you have here is seven recommendations that we came up with. Balance your egg take and go now. Takes three, four, and five. You let those eggs, that's why we raise cane. If you let those eggs come out of Forks Creek, we can't get them back. We can't get them back without stealing them from somewhere. And understand, all the eggs that came back last year to Forks Creek, 6.5, now down to 2.5. This year, what is it going to be? Less than a million. They've used all those eggs to backfill and create a totally irresponsible release in the cell. Okay? So I'd ask you to go through my seven. I'd ask you to consider all of them that we got. It's real simple. They can live with them. And when Ron says, well, you know, maybe we won't do this, you know, well, that's like either giving them a blank check or giving them a power of attorney to write the check to who they want. And they aren't proven to be trustworthy with that. Did my lock go off? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Kehoe.
So, thank you, Mr. Hamilton. Where is your shirt? Is it under? You have it underneath, or did you wear it?
No, I had to appear in court this morning.
Oh,
so.
I see.
I didn't want to explain it to the judge.
Judge, throw you in jail.
So, you know, appreciate your comments with regard to Nacelle, and just so for some of our newer commissioners too, and Ron, correct me if I'm wrong, but some of the actions that were taken with respect to hatchery production on the Nacelle were not coming from the front table here. They were coming from the legislature. And they said, here's the money. You shall raise these fish here. So let me finish, okay? So, you know, we think we're all mighty and powerful up here at this front table, and we are. but we've got some our partners across the street who actually have the pen, and I think you've heard of the phrase "the power of the pen." It is indeed very powerful. So I respect your comments with respect to Nacelle and your viewpoints, but I just want to make sure you, the rest of the audience, and the rest of the commission understand that the action taken with respect to Nacelle 2 years ago was done not by us, but by the legislature.
Can I respond?
Yes, sure.
I'm going to split this because this is a man that amended that policy, okay, that movement through the legislature. A, the legislature passed a provision that says we're going to give you $50,000, whatever it is. They didn't, and it was dedicated to the Nacelle, if you want to use it. Then there was an amendment attached to it.
Explain that.
The amendment said you can have this money to raise more than a Nacelle, and that would have brought it up to 2.8, I believe. Okay. The amendment said, if you follow HSRG.
And only then.
And that's the only way you can do it.
Okay. Marlisa?
Good morning.
Afternoon, I hope.
Afternoon. Well, it's a long drive from the NEMA. HSRG is important, and this policy has been under attack from the moment that we wrote it. And you all had a wonderful lecture that most of us have sat through several times. And what we came away with when we constructed that policy, that we couldn't have recovery unless we, you know, restricted our impact harvest to 14%. And to reduce the pain of teaching the commercial fleet to fish with less, they were granted a few additional years, knowing that if we wanted to have recovery, we were going to have to tighten our belt and fish at 14%. So I'm asking that you don't stand down that portion of the policy as you make your recommendation for 2020. Also, I would like to remind, and this is information that I get directly from Chad, in 2019, when they are looking across the board bay-wide, we did see a 5% increase in natural origin Chinook. And while it is small, and the department might want you to believe that that is not worth the effort to continue with the policy, I would argue that if they had enforced the policy where it should be, that gain would be bigger. But we have stood down important parts of that policy. The nacelle hatchery wasn't able to meet its own egg take. The commercial fleet was allowed to go in 4 days early, and those were primarily nacelle-bound Chinook out there, and they didn't make it to the river. So I'm asking you again not to stand down that portion of the policy. It is supposed to be after September 7th, no sooner than September 7th in the policy. And there's a reason for that. Those of us who live there and know how those fish migrate in the south end of the bay set that there for a reason. It wasn't to end commercial fishing. It was to make sure that we could guarantee recovery. There's still fish out there in the south end of the bay, for sure. You know, that's a week earlier than they get in the north end of the bay by being able to put the nets in, but no earlier than the 8th. It's important, and there was a reason for it. I have a lot to say, and I'm going to try to be really brief. We have a level 5 emergency at the NEMA. We talked about the weir issue, and I just want to bring this up and ask for your assistance again. I've been begging Chad. I've been begging Ron Warren and hatchery management individuals in that region. We have a horrible silting problem that caused the death of thousands of our returning Chinook in 2019 and 2018 because it remains unaddressed. There's 50 years of silt above the diversion dam, which every winter when we have a little water dumps, you know, thousands of yards. And we now have area where there are gravel bars, and we cannot have a healthy environment for a returning adult salmon in the river. They just don't breathe well on the gravel. I don't think we can adapt that quickly. And we need that area dredged out. Ross and I went and evaluated it 2 years in a row, and it is our estimate that about 400 yards needs to come out of there, not 50. 400 yards. It's an easy fix. Save our salmon. You need those eggs for every hatchery if you want to backfill to anywhere. We have to do that now. We needed it 2 years ago. Don't let another year go by. Thank you.
Melissa, I have one question. Did you make a comment or a recommendation on the 20 versus the 14? If you did, I didn't.
Yes, 14. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. In order to meet recovery, it needs to be 14%. We always knew that. Everyone knows it. But to, you know, it's like you need to go on a diet, but you're going to do it tomorrow. You know, we're going to do it tomorrow. It's always tomorrow. And I'm not.
All right.
Don't go there.
Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Mr. Lake. Mr. Durham. And Mark Ashley. Please.
My name is Bob Lake. I am actually an advisor for Wilma Bay, president of the Oil Association, also manager of the Wilma RPG. I'm going to try to do this quickly if I can, but we're sitting there listening to numbers and all kinds of bogus stuff. Now, remember last meeting when I gave some numbers about the surpluses? I sent this to you people. I don't know if you've got it.
We got it.
Did you read it?
Yeah.
Do you understand it? Those are all early surpluses. Those coho numbers, we're a total of 43,879 surplus coho in that five-year period. We had 35,772 surplus Chinook. So what I'm saying is with the problem we have with our natural spawning coho, we could still put a fishery together. If you do away with that policy, we would not have these surpluses. You can put some money back into the Pacific County economy. And that being the case, I think we could actually generate some revenue and actually have something good in the Willapa. And also, I would recommend what they did before about the eggs that are taken at each facility, utilize those facility, those eggs at each facility on the Chinook, get them back in the water, and also, if you start looking at the hatchery reform and all that, the Willapa was never a Chinook estuary. There was a few spotty Chinook in there. You just read the history, and it's all there. But, I mean, it, we got a lot of data, but, and I know Ron and Mark turned around, and they were trying to get through stuff that they hadn't read, and it was dumped on them, basically. So, but I mean, and they tried, but I mean, it, the whole thing is, and the numbers I gave you is right out of the hatchery release sheets, or the hatchery reports. So if you want to question my numbers, go for it, but you're not going to find any discrepancy there. That come right off the internet. So what I'm saying is we can make this work. Why do we want to sell them out and have all these surpluses early in the fish? If we fished early, we could have fisheries for everybody, and we could still generate, have our egg takes that we need. It's that simple. And I mean, I've got, also, back in the 80s and late 80s and early 90s, we had Chinook returns in the Willapa of up to 130,000 Chinook returning there. This is one, and this is a guy that raised a lot of those fish, because every egg that the hatchery did not utilize, we put in RSIs. RSIs do work. We had a lot of fish, and they contributed. They'll contribute to the orcas and the whole works. We got things that'll work if you guys will let us have the flexibility to put things in a proper perspective. And that's not getting a war between the rec and the commercials. And we're not commercials. We are fishing for the consumers. Period. Like Dale Beasley just spoke out a little bit ago. Am I 3 minutes up?
Your 3 minutes are up, Bob.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I hope, and ladies, thanks.
Thanks for coming up. Keep an eye on my house down there in Grayland, will you?
Was that one burnt down last night?
Bob. Thank you, Bob.
I was just joking.
I know. Mark, and then we'll go to...
Well, is this working?
It's working.
Okay, I'm going to muddle through this. The Willapa's had hatcheries on it since about 1900. I think that was the first one. And through the years, the sportsmen and the commercial fishermen back then, before the 1920s, recognized that we had to mitigate for all the farming, the logging, anything anybody does along a river impacts fish. So at one point, they decided they were going to try to put a hatchery on every stream, on every river, and they almost accomplished it at different times. Some of them didn't run very long. The Depression put a stop to that, and the state took over the hatchery systems, so, and then it progressed from there. So it gets to be the 70s, that's when I started fishing, and the fishery, we had coho, they produced coho, not very many Chinook, then they took on the Chinook program. And so that progressed through the 80s, peaked in the 90s, then they started cutting back. When they say we cut back in 2015 or adopted the new program, the new policy, it started earlier than that. It's just that they progressed it slowly on cutbacks. And so then they adopt this policy, and then they create a wild Willapa Chinook. It's always been recognized as a hatchery-based system in the ocean harvest, but they created a wild fish now. It's actually a naturally spawning hatchery progeny. All these fish genetically are all the same. There's no difference in any of them. So I don't know where this scientific hatchery review group came from that put in this policy. I tried to research a little bit. I couldn't figure out who instigated in the first place and who these individuals really are and who they represent, especially. I never could figure that out. I hope you guys can. But as this policy took place, the economic impact in that natural-based area down there, natural resource-based area, took a real hit. Because when you have farming, you got your fishing, you got your oysters, you got some cranberries, you got all these things are links in like a chain, very important in a rural area down there. And so to have this happen, it takes a link out, and it's not only the economics of it, it turns into part of the social part, the economic, social. There's a bigger effect than just the economics. And so my advice, or what I would like to see, is for this program, this policy, to be scrapped. Let's go back and produce the fish. All these arguments, when you had the fisheries department here and they're pointing these things out, all these things would be moot if we go back and produce fish again. You know, I mean, I just can't believe the fishery we had and where we're at now. We used to argue over who's going to catch the fish. Now we argue over if we even get to go fish. And then they said that the last program, disaster relief. We got disaster relief. Yeah, you're right, we did. And that was 4 years ago, and it took 4 years to get a check for it. You know?
We got to kind of wrap her up here a little bit.
I'm just getting warmed up is the hell of it, you know that. But
we're going to take a break, so you can keep talking during the break, but we got a couple other folks we got to get to as well.
Thank you.
Joe Durham, please.
Sitting next to him, I feel the heat. Hey, my name is Joe Durham again. I'm one of those derelict morons that hang out over at Walmart, as you can see by the colors that I'm wearing today. But I want to take a look at what's the, I think it's number 6 on your slides. 1997, you started seeing a tremendous drop in commercial harvest for Chinook. What happened? 2015, with the constraints put on by the wild fish within the Willapa system, and a policy that came in that is working by what the policy requires. What's wrong with the picture? And I'd like to go to Coho, and that's your slide number 9. You see pretty much the same thing there. Only 1 year in those few years that commercials went over 200,000 or 20,000, whatever the number of fish were for Coho. But you look at those years, you see that the policy is working as well. Only 1 year in that time that they met anywhere near what they had been doing historically, not even a quarter of what they've been doing historically. And from that point on, it's been very low for both the recreational and the commercials. So the policy is working the way that it's intended to work, but it's unfair to all the fishers involved. The money that the fishermen put in to come down and spend time, as everybody says, buying license, fuel, staying at motels, buying food. And now, on top of all that, we have the southern resident killer whale problem. This popped up about a year and a half, 2 years ago. Now we are directed, mandated by the governor, if I'm not mistaken, to provide Chinook and Chum for the killer whales in the hatchery program. That's going to allow a little bit more harvest because, you know, they're not. You put more out there, they're not going to take more than they are. And what happened with the killer whales in Washington State goes back to when the killer whales came into Puget Sound. They discovered they had a ready-made table there year-round with your Chinook blackmouth program. They started to case linger longer and longer and longer. Now they're there, and they come out for a little bit, and they almost starve to death. They come back to Puget Sound a little bit to eat, and they die from what they did in the ocean. I love killer whales. I think they're a marvelous animal, but we're going way too beyond what needs to be done. They will rebound in time. If you say global warming, that's the problem, so be it. But they will rebound. But fishermen, commercials, recreational guides, guys that get out and fish and put food on their table and help their neighbors out are the ones who are suffering. And the policy works. But as I said, it stayed for the last 2 or 3 years, you're turning Willapa Harbor into a cesspool. You're moving fish around that are, and Marissa said it, you're dying by the thousands in the NEMA. Thank you.
Joe, thank you. Good to see you. Bruce Ogren and Lise, Pacific County, welcome. Come on up. No, you.
Never heard of this shirt.
I've testified before you guys before, and thank you all for allowing me to do so. And I'm just going to preface it with saying again that these numbers make my head swim, but what I do know is the economy of Pacific County. And I think we're all a little closer to being on the same page than we think. But the legislature seems to have made, for whatever reason, for the orcas, fish production in Willapa Harbor a priority. And I think that we need to go with that. I think we are uniquely situated to keep fish production going in the Willapa because of the long history of the hatcheries, which, by the way, the state has dumped a lot of money into. Forks Creek has had extensive renovations. Nacelle is due to start this year, I believe, with extensive renovations, and we need to use them. Pacific County economy benefits from every kind of fishery. We are a natural resources-based county. We want to keep logging. We want to keep harvesting oysters. We want to keep raising fish. I'm going to the timber meetings also, and it's really interesting. They're setting aside thousands of acres of timber in Pacific County that we aren't going to be able to harvest and replant and treat as a natural resource due to habitat of a bird that they haven't done a survey on in over 20 years, and completely not being able to address the fact that habitat may not be the issue at all. These birds are supposedly starving, and that's why they're going somewhere else. They don't have enough fish. They don't have enough to eat, and they're going north to British Columbia. But that just doesn't seem to get addressed. It seems like everybody needs fish. So I'd really encourage you to... I know a lot of people put a lot of work into this policy, but and there may be portions of it from certain points of view that it's working. But all I know is the numbers are going down, and you've got the sport fishery is, I love to sport fish. I love it. But it's a vagabond fishery. You've got your license that you buy that you can take anywhere in the state. You take your pole, you take your boat, you take whatever it is you're going to do, you go on a charter, whatever it is you're going to do, and you're going to go where the fish are. The local fishermen that are the backbone of our county, of our local rural economy, along with the oyster farmers, along with the timber growers and the loggers, and everybody else that makes up our fabric, they buy a license for a hell of a lot more than a sport fisher does. They are restricted to a certain area. They were restricted to a certain time. And they have a business that they are trying to support on this very diminished fishery that we currently have. And I, as I said to begin with, I think that we are a lot closer to being on the same page than we think we are. I think we need to manage the fishery more in a real-world type setting rather than a government-type setting. We screw everything up in government. And I think we need to try and just do it with a common sense approach. And I would really urge you to consider that and consider, if not completely redoing the policy. I don't believe this is working for our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Bruce?
My name's Bruce Ogren. Live in South Bend all my life, Pacific County. Started commercial gill netting with my dad as a young teenager. My brother and I started fishing in 1970 on our own boat. Have 50 years in on fishing Willapa Bay gill net. And back in the old days, in the 70s, we could go fishing and we had time and area. And we had Chinook, Chum, and Coho. We were just limited by the amount of time we could fish. And we had predator control on marine mammals till the federal government prohibited that, which needs to be reinstated to control the impact on hatchery returning fish and outgoing smolt on some of the birds. And I think this policy that's been drummed up is a killer or a nail in the coffin of commercial gillnet fisheries in Willapaw Bay, period. I think there needs to be common sense that the commission go back and review the production of 1980s and look at the Pacific fisheries marine mammal on their so-called natural spawning that returned when we had those large returns of 60, 80, 100,000 Chinook in that system. And with this current policy, it absolutely needs to be changed on the Chinook that the release of Forks Creek be brought up to what they took in eggs this 2019 and released at Forks Creek to supplement those other hatcheries. Crucial. And then since we had a July, August, and September fisheries in those previous years up to 2000 and somewhere in there where we harvest larger numbers of fish. Well, with this recreational priority on Chinook, you have over escapement into the hatchery on Chinook, and that's where you get your large egg takes. In relation to the Nema hatchery, that's a mud hole. It's been a chum producer, maybe coho. You're trying to put $3 million out of a stream that doesn't have water quality. In the last two previous years, it's had itch in it where it devastated the Chinook returns. So, and then on the wild salmon deal, if I'm wrong, maybe Ron Warren will correct me, but my understanding on the genetics of the Willapaw Bay Chinook salmon, 99.9% are hatcheries original genetics. Thank you for your time.
Bruce, thanks for coming in. Have a good day. Amy, you want to go ahead before we adjourn? Take a break, excuse me?
Yeah.
Hurry.
Okay, slight change in your agenda. I just wanted to take a minute and introduce you to Marvin Williams, who is our DEI manager. You will be getting emails from him. They go out to all staff. He's part of our overall effort to, you know, really live our values and be a more respectful workplace. So I just wanted to introduce you to Marvin. You can have like 1 minute, Marvin. Go.
Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Nice to meet you. I have a great amount of hill to climb, but it's going to be fun, and I'm having a great time getting to know everybody, and I'm loving it. I appreciate the opportunity Amy and everybody has given me to be the positive change agent in the Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Good. You tell us what the I don't know what the abbreviation is.
Oh, yeah. Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Manager.
Okay.
He's in our HR department, and he helps with training. He's part of our red flag reporting, so when folks report issues around culture or bias or harassment, they go to Marvin first, so he's part of that overall effort to sort of make sure we're a place for all people.
And the ADA link.
And the ADA link, that's right. That's right.
Welcome aboard.
Could you give us a little of your background?
Yes, I'm from Tacoma, born and raised. Did 21 years in the military as a combat medic. I did this duty as well in the military, as well as work with victims of sexual harassment and sexual assault. Then retired in 16, spent 3 years at Western State Hospital as a ward administrator, and had a great time, met a lot of great people, learned a lot, and then this is my calling. So this is what I do. Doctors go to school to become doctors. This is what I do. I take care of people. So
we need a lot of tree
hugs.
Well, thank you very much. Welcome aboard. We'll look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you.
Okay, we are going to take a break now. It is 3:45. We're going to take a break until 4. And when we get back, a decision will be made on Willapaw. There it goes. Okay. Okay, who wants to lead off here?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, go ahead, Bob. Sorry, I'm trying to get my machine going here.
So I think I'm going to ask staff to come up. And so I have two questions. Could you please go to slide 4? There?
Yeah.
Okay. So, so Commissioner McIsaac asked a couple of questions on the predicted impacts. So, you know, you look at that impact rate predicted. And so in 2019, even though the guidance provided the impact rate of 20% on Willapa Bay Wild Chinook, we were predicting 15.4%, and I think your answer to Commissioner's McIsaac's question is, you know, why 15.4, why not 20? And I think your answer was, Ron, correct me if I'm wrong, there were other kind of constraining factors, coho, chum, what have you, right? Is that a fair characterization of your response?
Chair Carpenter, Commissioner Kehoe, exactly. So I think that if we're trying to plan, as we have an ocean fishery 1st of July into the middle part of August and transition to the Willapaw rules and step away from ocean rules, to set the remainder of that season, I think we're going to be constrained by the number of wild coho returning to meet the goals. And then if you say, oh, okay, I'm going to go late, just to re-explain what I was saying, then if you're going to go late where you're going to talk about, okay, let's get into a chum fishery, coho are present in the bay all the way through November during the chum fishery, not in fantastic numbers. I'm not trying to paint a picture of, oh my gosh, but you've got some incidental impacts there that we're going to have to be cognizant of when we're setting the fishery this year.
And this is not a fair question, and I'll just let you know.
Kurt will answer this
one. I'm going to ask it anyway. So as you sit here today, what do you think... With the constraints that you're already talking about, what do you think the impact rate would look like for 2020? Assuming if the commission approved the rollover of 2019 guidance to 2020, which allowed for 20% impact.
So, as I look at that, Commissioner Kehoe, I look at 2019, and I say we had a guidance of 20% in 2019 per slide 4. In that, in our preseason planning, we were only able to plan to 15.4% because of other constraining populations, and we were only able to hit 14.7%. We have a declining coho population coming back this year, which will further constrain that, and then further constrain the other side of the coho run on top of it.
Okay. So 14%?
This may be premature. I think that if I would have had the luxury of having talked to staff and having an understanding of the forecasts that are coming back to us and understanding the possible dilemma that we're going to have relative to similar Chinook, poor Coho, possibly poor Chum because of the environmental conditions in the ocean. If I were going to now preface what staff recommendation should be, I think that I would modify that to say, take us back to the policy as written, the original policy, but retain the 10% cap on Chum, only because I don't think we can get there anyway because of the Coho population coming back. And so I don't think, I don't think you're going to, those numbers are going to, we're going to be able to hit those numbers because of overall fish available for the harvest. And I think that that shows still trying to maximize opportunity while achieving conservation goals, and that's what our mission is.
Okay, so I'm sorry, I didn't.
Sorry.
So your recommendation then with respect to impacts rates for wild Chinook is what?
Go back to the original
14%.
Policy, which goes to 14%.
Okay. And then, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I just have one other question. Can you go to slide 6? And we heard some testimony today concerning the earlier start time for the commercial fishery and how that negatively impacted the 8 egg take at Nacelle. I mean, if I'm just looking, and we don't have that all that data in front of us, so I'm just trying to truth that. So if I look at 2019 and I look at the blue commercial harvest of Chinook, it's pretty skinny. And so I'm just wondering if staff has any insight or could kind of verify or refute the contention that somehow the action in allowing the earlier commercial fishery in the South Bay had anything to do with the egg take situation at Nacelle.
So thinking back to the presentation that you received in January, the harvest estimates for the commercial fishery were in there. My recollection, and I'll speak in somewhat round numbers here, is that the commercial fishery in total harvested about 1,500 hatchery origin Chinook. The sport fishery took about 1,000. And of that commercial harvest, less than half of that was taken in the 2M area, so down towards the Nacelle, so largely Nacelle origin and some Nima origin Chinook. So that in mind, we had about 400 pond mortalities, and we surplused about 1,000 fish out of the Nacelle hatchery during the 2019 return year. So the one thing I would comment on is that the fishery structure was developed in advance of increasing the escapement goal or the egg take to the 5 million. Right. So yes, we would have made the, that 2.5 whatever million that we ended up with is pretty darn close to the goal that we started preseason planning with.
But then we increased it kind of after the season, and that was a result of kind of the legislature's action in terms of improvement. Very good reminder. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I don't have any more.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a motion formulated at the moment, but I'll offer a few thoughts here. I wonder if you could go to slide 17, and I'll just offer my thoughts, and then I can hear from the other commissioners about where they might want to go. The overarching theme in my thinking here is to preserve options for the comprehensive review that's coming. We had hoped we wouldn't be offering guidance here for deviating from the policy at this time because the comprehensive review would have been done and we'd be looking at the policy as it might be changed or the same. But it struck me that everybody in the public testimony, I think every one of them, had at least some changes in mind for the current policy of one sort or the other. So I'm thinking about preserving our options because it appears when the comprehensive review is over that a lot of people will be looking for some changes. Who knows for sure what they all might be, but we've seen some. So let me first start with the 2019 Broodyear Fall Chinook releases. The staff recommendation here is to release the Chinook in their current abundances. I know that we heard testimony from the public and from the Twin Harbors advocacy folks to not do that, but rather move some of the eggs around. There's a slide earlier that has the survival rates from the three hatcheries. I don't remember which slide that is. Staff, do you know which that one is? What number that is? Number 13? No. It's
yeah, it is.
The bottom of 13. So what strikes me here is that the NEMA has the lowest survival rate of the bunch, and we heard that maybe it's some disease ick things, maybe it's silting, I'm not sure what it is, but if we didn't make our full egg take this last year, moving eggs from a hatchery that has a higher survival rate, both those 0.43s are about 50% higher survival rate than the 0.28, doesn't strike me as a good idea. So I think we ought to maximize our survival rate in this troubled times, and so my thinking is on the egg take to go with the staff recommendation, release the fish where they're at now. And again, this preserves the options. Some people would say if you stick to the plan, you're releasing too many fish in the north, but I think we need to preserve our options. On the matter of the fishing part, if you could turn to slide 16, whether or not to go back to the 14% in the original plan or stay with the 20%, recall last year that one of the considerations was that we signed a new treaty with Canada that reduced ocean fishing in the area where these fish go, and that the original 14% presumed heavier fishing in the north. That's now not happening, and 20% now inside the bay is about the same as 14% was back when the policy was adopted. So in some way, it's kind of moot which of those two you pick, unless you think you're going to press up against 20 or 15. But when I heard Mr. Warren talk about the commercial constraints, that the commercial impact rate's not likely to be high because there's going to be coho problems late, and there's going to be coho problems in the middle. And if we look at the whole picture, I think what I heard was, be hard to generate a very high impact rate in the commercial fishery this year given the mix. On the sport fishery side, with the low returns headed to the north where most of the best sport fishing is, last year the fishery was poor, the effort was low, and the impact rate was low there. So it makes me think we're probably not going to have a very high impact rate in the north. If some people think that the sport fishery ought to be constrained in the north to get more eggs into Forks Creek so that that program has a chance of building, if we do have changes to the after the comprehensive review, I don't know that I'm in favor of that because I feel like the poor success rate is going to drive that impact rate down. So I get to the point of being comfortable that the impact rate of 14 or 20 is probably not going to be challenged given this year's conditions. Flexibility in determining bag limits. I think it's good for the staff to have flexibility in entertaining ideas on that. And the commercial fishery, I think what the staff has done in the past on looking at time and area, well, the last 2 years resulted in a much lower impact than expected. Meat for coho, I'm very comfortable with the staff position of expecting very poor fishing. And if there needs to be closures in both fisheries to meet the escapement goal, that's what fishery management does. And you take care of the escapement goals first. The chum impact of 10%, we just heard Mr. Warren say that that might be a good thing to retain, and he was not very favorable for chum salmon either. So it's a pretty negative situation this year, but I guess I get back to the point of being comfortable with both staff recommendations. I'd wait to hear from the other commissioners.
Mr. Thorburn.
Yeah, mine starts with, Ron, could I have a little clarification on your response to Commissioner Kehoe's first question? Were you talking, with this slide, were you talking solely about the impact rates there, or were you talking about the full, you said, you referred to the impact rates, but then you said return to the policy. I, like Commissioner McIsaac, especially in these years of so much uncertainty, to provide some flexibility to staff on the ground. So I kind of like the staff flexibility in determining bag limits, and no restrictions on time and place to allow you to really respond on the ground in the best way to assure conservation goals and also to provide whatever opportunity can be given to all sectors.
Chair Carpenter, Commissioner Thorburn, if I were going to give you a true interpretation of the policy, I have the ability to adjust bag limits through the adaptive management approach, even if you were to go back to the original policy as written. So I think I have that flexibility whether we stay with 2019 or go back to the original policy as written. So I think I can achieve what you're trying to give us that flexibility to do. Does that answer your question?
Commissioner Griffin. After listening to staff and the concerns of other commissioners here, I think what I tend to recommend that we consider is the 14% rate cap on unmarked Chinook. I think through monitoring, I agree that we might be able to be flexible on time and area. I'm not a real believer in these fixed dates. Fish don't have a calendar or a watch, and I'm hoping through monitoring that we can be a little bit flexible in that to the benefit of both commercial and recreational fishers. And I think it's important that we keep a 10% impact rate on chum. Those are the high points for me, and also I think I agree that we should release the Chinook in their current abundances as well. That's where I'm at, and if we can get a consensus on that, then we can move on.
This is a tough one. This is not an easy situation, but what we're talking about is a one-year deal till we get through the comprehensive review, and instead of cherry picking and building our own recipe, I think I'm going to recommend taking the most conservative approach and go back to the original policy, with the exception of the 10% cap on chum salmon.
So is that a motion?
It is.
Second.
Did you want to include the food stock?
Yeah.
Well, we can do that.
We
can do a second motion on that. But I'm not hard over.
No.
What is this? What would you folks like to do? We can wrap it in.
I think we're all in agreement on that, pretty much. But release the Chinook in our current abundances was also the staff recommendation.
So do they want to amend?
I'll leave that up to Ron. I want to go back to the original policy.
I suggest we do, Commissioner.
I'm not the chair. But
no, I didn't hear what you said.
Okay.
Chair, sorry.
Go ahead. Clarification.
If that was a motion, we've got a multitasking legal counsel here, and I would suggest that we write down what the motion is.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Good.
Ron. Did you have a question, Molly?
On the CHUM impact rate, so that would...
10%?
Well, that's not in the...
That's a deviation.
Yeah.
No, yeah, that's a deviation. That's
it is. It's part of this motion.
That's not part of the original policy. That's, yeah.
Okay.
Staff recommendation.
Trying to understand.
I hear you.
So I'm not great at parliamentary procedures or Robert's rules, but what Commissioner Carpenter, if that becomes a motion, you've just limited releases to the facilities per the policy, and now you're going to go back and modify the policy. I think you may want to add the piece of that the eggs are taken if it's the choice of the commission to release the abundances at the locations they're at. You may want to incorporate that into a motion for consideration.
Why don't you rescind your second?
I rescind.
Okay. My motion is pending. You want to add the egg tank piece in? You articulated a few minutes ago, and then we can wrap it up again.
Thing might get complicated, so I would make a motion on just the egg take thing and see if we can get through a baby step.
Go ahead and do that there.
Okay, so I would move that we accept the staff recommendation to release the fall Chinook in their current abundances at the current hatcheries.
Second. Now, Commissioner Anderson, or was that Graybill?
Okay.
Commissioner Graybill seconded the motion.
It's a standalone motion.
It is. Is there any further discussion on that motion? Okay.
On that motion.
Yeah. All right. Having heard that, let's call for the motion. Call for the question. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
Okay. And your motion?
Yes.
So,
go ahead, Bob.
I would like to make a motion that's slightly different than yours with respect to the fisheries, the other part of the equation, not the egg tank. So my motion is,
are we at slide 16?
Yes.
Is to carry over or to accept, I'm sorry, to carry over the 2019 Fish and Wildlife Commission guidance to 2020, except for a 14% impact rate on unmarked Chinook, and that's it. I mean, everything except for the impact rate. Lower that from 20% to 14%. That's my motion.
Let's see it on the screen before he asks for a second.
Well, I'm willing to second it.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
So.
All right.
Joe, could you use a higher font for some of our senior citizens?
Let me get it typed out here.
I'm not dealing with spring chickens.
You've been doing it all day. I have my notice.
Just do this.
All right. Yep.
Just expand here.
Okay. We have a motion and a second by Commissioner Thorburn.
Well,
he's still typing.
But he lost his thing.
Oh, he lost your mojo.
Yeah. Changed computers.
Just go back to expand.
Well, don't ask me to say it again because I won't be
able to. There we go.
So, can you make it bigger?
That is bigger.
Oh, that was.
then the rest of it is just
Bob, that was unmarked Chinook.
Unmarked Chinook.
Yeah, unmarked. Yeah.
Unmarked Chinook.
There you go. Michigan Chinook.
Just a little bit.
That's a seconded motion, right?
Yeah, they're still discussing.
But we could always come back.
It was been seconded.
Is it all okay up there?
Yeah, hang on.
If I could speak to the
Vice Please, Mr. Kehoe.
I know it's late in the day, but this is important stuff, and I think we owe it to ourselves and staff and the public. So, I'm struggling with this 14 versus 20%. In my view, I don't want to use the 14%. The way I, given what you're saying, Ron, is that in your view, we, for fishery planning purposes, with all the other constraining factors, that we would not actually be able to have a fishery at 20% unmarked. So I just want to let people know I don't think we should use 14% moving forward as we evaluate the policy. I just want to make that clarification. And I also do think this underscores my prior comments before, and that is the need for an in-season update for Chinook. We've got one for Coho. We've got one for Chum, which employs the commercial gear, Gillnet CPU. I strongly think, and I mean, I don't know, if I don't want to include that in the motion, but I want to just lay that out there for everybody to consider and have in the back of staff's mind. So, thank you.
If I may, Bob, I agree with your comments. And the only thing I just want to add to this, and I know it's a frustrating thing for you, Ron, is the difficulty we've had in moving forward with this comprehensive review. But now we have kind of a time layout, and I think we all look forward to that so we can do a better job of pulling the right string at the right time. So that's any other comments? Seeing none. We have a motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
No, I'm not opposed. Sorry, I was raising my hand hoping to talk.
Oh, okay.
Chair Carpenter, commissioners, thank you. I know the decisions we just made are not easy. As we heard from county commissioners and small business owners and recreationalists in Pacific County and elsewhere, this is an impact on all of them. I would like to acknowledge that we've received some very thoughtful policy language for consideration, and I want to assure the people that have provided that staff will retain that or for commission consideration as we complete the comprehensive review, and assure them that we will bring that back as a public comment later in the year for your consideration as we possibly determine modification of the policy language. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ron. Commissioner Baker?
My comment is not to the policy, but something that's been raised repeatedly today, which is the problems with some of the creeks, rivers near these hatcheries. I was at NEMA, I believe, just after a big die-off. There were a couple little fish above the weir. There was a muddy pond on the other side of the weir that wasn't half the size of this room, and it wasn't more than a foot and a half deep. So I guess I hope it doesn't take more than 15 minutes at some point, not today, but I'm hoping that somebody can really explain to me why we can invest so many millions of dollars in hatcheries and we can't fix those kind of problems. I'm asking for that.
If I may, Ron, because I think it's a follow-up to hers, and I don't remember exactly what river it was on either, but the 200 yards of silt and the potential need for removal of that and the dredging piece, Is that something that's practical, doable, or permittable?
Chair Carpenter, I think that unknown whether or not our operational HPA for hatcheries would allow us to go back in and dredge for operational purposes what Ms. Dugan was talking about. What I have committed to, so commissioners know, is that there's she spoke to maintenance at the facility, and I spoke to that in my presentation as well. And I committed to come out and meet with her and other members of advisors or the general public to maybe have a roundtable discussion. We have invested a great deal of money in Forks Creek to remodel Forks Creek. We have a kind of a plan in place and reappropriated other money for the reconstruction or remodel of the nacelle facility. We need to get NEMA on the list so that it's an effective facility beyond its current aged and deteriorated state, and I want to go have a conversation with the public to talk about that. Okay, yeah, you're in.
I encourage that too, and once you do the site visit and do an inventory of that, I would appreciate it. I can't physically be there, that you bring that back to the commission so we see an update on that and progress as it's unfolding.
I didn't think I was going to get more assignments from my what I said, but I'd be happy to do that, Chair or Commissioner Smith. I'm gone.
Okay, that wraps up. We'll look up Ron. Thank you very much.
You bet.
Kurt, thank you very much. Ryan Canesco, thank you very much.
He did it.
We have one more item left.
Blame me.